Welcome to IT2 Module 9. So we've only got a small group, but let's have a quick quiz. A user wishes to share a local printer with other users on the network. How would the user configure the printer for sharing? Would they go to A, Start, Control Panel, Printers, right click on the printer name and choose Sharing from the menu? Or would they B, go to My Computer, Properties, Printers, Sharing? Or C, My Network Places, Sharing, Printers, and select the appropriate printer? Yes, you are correct. It is A. That's it. Question 2. What must be done to configure the FTP services for Windows 2000? Is it A, the IIS component must be loaded? B, the user must connect to the server using FTP? C, the network operating system must be reinstalled to include FTP? Yes, you are correct. A, it's the IIS. Yep. Question 3. When installing Windows 2000, the setup wizard will ask you for a computer name.
I got a big, huge pause during that. And I think I'm on a delay.
Okay. What is the maximum number of characters allowed for the computer name? Is it A, 8, B, 15, C, 36, D, 127? Yes, and B is correct, 15. Hang on, you're not hearing me, are you? Which of the following file systems would be most appropriate for a Windows 2000 disk partition? Is it A, FAT16, B, FAT32, C, NTFS, D, EXT2, or E, EXT3? Yes.
Can I just guess and say C, because I was actually on the Mac server?
Yes, it was C, NTFS. Okay, next question. Which scripting language is widely used in Windows 2000? Is it A, VBScript, B, Shell Script, C, Rex, or D, Perl Script? Yep, that's the one, VBScript. Correct, Amondo. Next question, which level of control does the system administrator have over the network operating system? Is it A, user account, B, system backup, C, network security, or D, complete? Yeah, good one. Yes, complete. Okay, an administrator wants to only allow a user to view the contents of a file and execute a program in Windows 2000. Which of the following permissions should be set? A, write, B, read, C, execute, D, full control, or E, modify? Oh, sorry, I didn't say choose to.
I sort of missed the question. I got execute, and that's about it. What do you want to do with the file? Read it, execute?
You want to be able to view it and execute it. So you need A, write, B, read, C, execute, D, full control, or E, modify. B and C is correct. Read and execute. That's correct. Okay, which of the following commands will enable users to discover the IP configuration on a Windows XP computer? Is it A, ping localhost, B, ipconfig/all, C, ifconfig, or D, netstat? That's on a Windows XP. Yep, you're correct. ipconfig/all. Okay. Next question. What is the purpose of the user's full name in the new user account box? A, it is for information only. B, it authenticates the username. C, it allows the user to log on. Or D, it matches the user permissions. That's correct. Yes, it's only for information. Okay. Yeah, I will shortly. Which three of the following passwords are considered unacceptable? Is it A? I will do yes, no. A, SCOP, S-C-O-P. Unacceptable.
Yes, it's unacceptable.
Yeah, it's unacceptable. Yeah. Okay, now we've got one, NET, N-E-T.
It's going, no, it is unacceptable.
Yeah. Four, number four, and then work. Acceptable or not acceptable? Yes, no. Yeah, it is acceptable. That's right. Okay, now we have capital E of the word Ethernet, and the word is Ethernet. Acceptable or unacceptable? That's right. Okay, now this one, Cisco number 5. Acceptable or not acceptable? Okay. Now we have this one. The number 14, lowercase a, uppercase f, all lowercase tap, exclamation mark. Acceptable or not? Yep. Okay, then we have both lowercase, pa, and then the number 55. That's it. Okie doke. That is all of the quiz, and I'll just hand over to Kerry for a tick, and I'll go on AutoVox too.
Okay, welcome to Module 9, which deals with the installation of Linux. What we are going to do today is we're going to do a brief overview of the installation steps of Linux, and we are going to try and cover the things that are going to show up in the final exam if you happen to be installing Red Hat 7.2. I would strongly recommend against installing Red Hat 7.2 in 2009, as it is rather dated. It's out of date by 5 or 6 years, and anybody who has run Linux would know that Linux moves very quickly, and you will find that a lot has changed since 2003. Just a general run around here. Are you running Fedora Core 10 or 11, Elise, if you happen to be listening?
Yep. If I'm happening not to be lurking, I'm running Fedora 10 on two of my machines, and in about a week or so's time, I will be putting 11 onto my EEE PC alongside Windows.
When did 11 come out? Any idea?
Yep. Where are we up to? Yes. Was it as far back as April? I'll have to check. No, it can't be. 10 came out. It's usually on a 6-monthly rotation. So 6 came out in late November 2008. So I'd say 11 must have showed up around. I know I've got it here. It's sitting here as an ISO image. It would have come out around about
April,
probably June, April, May, June. I can check for you, but I'll will in the tick.
That's
but
fine.
11's the current version as of the time of this lecture.
And basically what's happened with Red Hat, which is something to be aware of, is that Red Hat basically decided they weren't making enough money on their Linux distributions because people weren't paying for support and stuff. So what they ended up doing was they split their division into two different sections. One of them was the Fedora project, which is a community-based bleeding-edge features whiz-bang distribution, which they called Fedora Core. And people would know that a fedora is a hat, hence the pun on Red Hat, fedora. Okay, we're over that now. And they also had Red Hat Enterprise, which you pay quite a lot for, and you license it and all that sort of good stuff, and it's got the commercial support and stuff like that. The upshot of this, basically when Red Hat released the RPM package spec, now none of this is in your notes, but it's kind of handy to know, so here we go. RPM is called the Red Hat Package Manager, which is in your test, and you install RPMs on Red Hat and Mandrake, so that's RPMs on Red Hat and Mandrake and SUSE, okay? RPMs, right, good. And basically a whole lot of distributions took up this Red Hat Package Manager format. And basically you ended up with a whole stack of Linux distributions that had Red Hat, that had RPMs in them. Don't be tempted to install the RPMs from one Linux distribution into another, Craig, because sometimes it will work perfectly well, and other times it will make a horrible mess, depending on how system-dependent your installs are. So don't try and drop... if you're doing it across, say, Fedora or Red Hat Enterprise, you're usually fairly safe, but if you try and put SUSE RPMs onto Red Hat, you're asking for trouble. And if you're clever enough to fix that trouble up, go right ahead, and if you're not, it will make a terrible mess of your system. Okay, as of Red Hat 7, they introduced dependencies, which meant you could actually tell what was dependent on what and what needed what, which was a big step, because before that you used to just be able to drop the RPMs on and all sorts of terrible things would happen if you didn't have the right pre-dependencies in. Okay, now back to focusing on the installation of these operating systems. The notes say that you should plan the installation of your operating system. What? You've already ripped the CD out of the box. You've already tried installing it onto your hard disk. You've already managed to erase your carefully unbacked up data. All right.
Oh boy, you're in trouble.
These are the things you've got to try and avoid. And it is possible with the installation of any operating system to remove data unintentionally from your computer, and that can cause you quite a bit of grief and heartache. So I would suggest that you ensure that there is no important data on your machine or that the data has been adequately backed up. And you also ensure that when you do the install, you have an idea of where you're going to install Linux to, how much space you're going to allocate for it, and what partition structure you're going to use.
I think that's pretty important too with the planning, isn't it? Of any, as you say, of any operating system, it's very important, to, even if you've done it before, to sit down and think about it before you do it. And to, you know, just to don't assume that you know and it's all a breeze, because you can run into strife otherwise.
Well, I'm currently in that exact same situation at the moment. I have here on my desk a Triple E PC with a 320GB hard drive in it that we upgraded the hard drive some time ago. Currently, it has a NTFS Windows system on it, which will actually stay. So I'm just trying to work out this weekend what size I want to resize the NTFS partition out of that 320GB hard drive, and how much room I want to leave for Linux. And if so, even if I want a spare data partition on top of that, once I've decided all that, I'll go ahead and do it.
And you'll make sure that there's no important data on your Windows partition that you haven't backed up in case the installation
Correct.
Of Red Hat goes wrong.
In case something goes wrong. Exactly.
And I think, you know, they all pop up a screen that says, please make sure you've had adequate backups and please make sure that you've got your data backed up. And people just click, yeah, whatever. And then when things go terribly wrong, or they don't have any UPS protection and the power drops out in the middle of install and they end up with a corrupt install image, they get quite upset. So I'd really recommend that people take this planning step seriously. Also, funnily enough, having some idea of what you're going to do before you actually do it actually will make the install procedure a lot more pleasant than if you are guessing your way through it. Okay, now there are a number of ways of installing Linux. Okay, so you've backed up all your stuff and you've planned your installation. Okay, the other thing I'm going to say, and this is going to upset a whole lot of people, try reading the installation document. There is actually an installation manual that comes with Linux. And funnily enough, if you read it, it might tell you some things like what you might need to know. For example, the minimum system requirements, possible pitfalls and problems with hardware that you might have trouble installing. And it will also tell you limitations and bugs in the actual installer. So do have a flip through that install documentation. They don't just put it on the CD to make it look pretty. I don't know whether anybody's aware. Has anybody ever actually... I know I've read a couple of them. Has anybody actually looked at the Windows CD and actually read the README file that comes with Windows?
Yeah.
No, not quite.
For Windows 7, I did, because I wanted to know how to install it and if there were any problems.
Also, I've read it with Windows 95 even, because there was actually some compatibility things between double space and a couple of other things that I needed to know about, and if I hadn't read about that, I would have ended up with an unbootable system.
Yeah, not good.
Okay, multiple ways of installing Linux. You've basically got to find some way of bootstrapping the kernel and the these days the initial RAM disk, although we didn't have initial RAM disks in Red Hat 7.2. If you want to know what an initial RAM disk is, go and Wikipedia it up. I'm not talking about it this lecture, except to say that it's a method of loading a RAM disk image of drivers and bootstrapping code into memory when the bootloader comes up so that you can actually have support for USB and stuff. Now, this is an interesting... We'll come back to this later. So basically what you do is you have to figure out how you're going to boot the installation. Are you going to boot it off floppy disks? Yes, that's still possible. Are you going to boot it off CD? Are you going to boot it off thumb drives? Are you going to reach over and nudge Grace when she yawns? There we are. Or are you going to install Linux from files that you have pre-copied to the hard disk? So you can actually kickstart the install from an operating system partition. This is also true for Windows. I don't know whether anybody's aware, but you can actually format a partition as FAT32, copy the Windows XP i386 folder down onto the hard disk, and actually start the install from the hard disk. Has anyone ever done that?
No, I know you can start it from a hard disk using like anything above Vista or Vista up, but I didn't know you could do it before that.
In fact, one of the things that used to prevent Windows 95 from installing on a lot of machines was unreliable CD-ROM hardware. And in fact, if you actually look down the bottom of the README file in Windows 95, it actually suggests you copy the Win95 folder off the CD into a folder called C:\Win95flat and start the install from there.
Yeah, I think I did a couple of Windows 98 installations like that. Again, for the same problem, you got worried if it would die during the CD-ROM part of the copy.
Absolutely.
So I'd put it down somewhere else, make sure that copy was all right, and then do it from there. These days I'm not so worried because the reliability of the hardware is better.
It can be, although I think they actually rejigged the installer routines to actually make sure that they did a better... Well, I don't know whether you used to, whether you noticed, but in Windows 95 and stuff, you had a whole stack of big cab files, whereas in Windows XP and stuff, you've got about, you know, hundreds of little tiny files that do have their own checksums in them, so they get verified as they get come off CD, and the installer's actually smarter about re-pulling the data off a second time if it sees an initial read in the first instance of pulling it off the media. Okay, so you figure out how you're going to install Linux. Are you going to boot it from a CD? Are you going to boot it from a couple of floppy disks? Are you going to boot it from a couple of floppy disks and then do the rest of the install from the CD? Are you going to do it from the network? Are you going to do it from a USB stick? Or are you going to do it from a hard disk partition? Now, you might sort of ask yourself, well, why do I even have to concern myself, because every computer I have ever seen has a bootable CD-ROM drive. Whilst that is often the case, there are some times where there are certain computers that don't have a CD-ROM drive, or there are certain computers where the CD-ROM drive is broken and you've stopped running Windows on it because you can't install Might of Mindless Fury 7 and you've decided to put Linux on the machine, so you need another method of being able to install the operating system without the use of a CD-ROM drive. Just a note there, that game title... That game title was constructed.
You might even have a netbook that doesn't have a CD drive.
And you don't have enough money to go and buy one.
Which is my case, but fortunately I do have enough money to buy one, and we'll be booting it, getting it to boot off the CD-ROM through, plugging it into to the USB port.
This is a yes-no question, because we don't want to get into this too much in lecture. Did you see the big Asus sellout on Catch of the Day yesterday?
Oh yes.
Oh, I wish I had the extra money. Might have got a couple. That was great.
I think we all did.
Just a note that the external CD DVD burners were in small fish for $67.90, so keep your eyes open. They might come up again. That's a pretty good price for an external DVD burner.
Yeah, I got one. Well, probably about a month or so. On the recommendation of a mutual friend on that.
Yeah, they're normally about the $90 mark.
They are, yeah. Or were, but on these sites web in Australia, they've been coming down a bit.
Okay, so basically you are booting the thing from the CD. Can anybody tell me how you get a machine to boot from a CD? Does it happen by default?
If you make it happen by BIOS, then yeah, can you just press a key when it says press a key to boot from the CD?
Linux disks don't say that. Yeah, no, I was just pointing this out, because with Windows it says press a key to boot from CD, because you expect Windows users to be silly enough to leave the disk in the drive and forget about it, whereas with the Linux disks, if you put a Linux disk in the CD, it will usually throw you up at a boot prompt, and you don't press a key to boot from CD, because that message is actually thrown up by the XP or Vista or Windows 7 CD bootloader, not by the BIOS, so just be aware of that.
Hmm,
if you boot a Linux CD, they just boot.
I thought that was thrown up by the BIOS. Oh, very good.
No, it's not.
Okay, thanks for that. I have seen that message.
I don't know, this isn't really part of this lecture, but there is actually, when you actually slipstream a disk by hand, which is possible to do before you actually went out and got Nlyte and got real, you could actually do it. You actually had to grab the Windows bootloader, which was four sectors that went on the beginning of the disk, and that was the thing that was responsible for popping up that thing that says press any key to boot from CD. But no, that is actually generated by the CD bootloader, not the BIOS. And in fact, if you get a copy of GRML or a copy of Fedora or a copy of whatever Linux distribution you happen to be installing, and you connect your USB CD-ROM to your EE PC and boot it, you will actually find that the CD will boot if you've got it first in the boot sequence.
Yeah, if it doesn't automatically boot, I'll go into BIOS and fix it and worry about it at the time.
Often also, I think with the EEPCs, I'm not sure what the actual key is, I'd have to Google it up. I think if you keep DACing F11, it'll actually pull up a boot menu, and then you can select which device you want to come up from. And most modern computers actually have a way where you can press a function key until a boot menu comes up. And then if you happen to have no sighted assistance, you can K and FB reader the screen and figure out how many down arrows you're going to press before you hit enter, and it should boot off the CD. Or you can keep rebooting the thing and pulling the menu up until you luck out and actually hit the CD-ROM. That is one way of doing it. Bit time-consuming, 5 or 10 minutes, but it will work. Also, another thing to be aware of, if you are booting your machine from an external USB hard disk, there are many devices that actually detect the hard disks when you actually boot the things up, and you cannot explicitly put USB hard disk first in the boot sequence unless it's connected to the machine. So it's often easier for a blind person to get a computer to boot from a CD-ROM drive than it is for them, even an external USB one, than it will be to get them to boot from a flash stick or an external hard disk, because those devices are handled differently in the ASUS BIOSes, so just be aware of that. And they were saying that some Linux distributions, brackets, most of them, these days, ship on DVD-ROM. Now, when this course was written, DVD-ROMs weren't as popular as they are now. This was back in 2003. And a DVD-ROM, or a DVD plus 5 disk, as they're known, can store 4.7 drive manufacturer's gigabytes worth of data, or 4,489 MIBI bytes. And a dual-layer disk can store twice that. There are bigger disks than that, but we won't concern ourselves with those at this particular point. So most operating systems ship on DVD these days, although Ubuntu tends to ship on a CD and pulls the rest of the stuff it needs from the network. Now, I'm just trying to remember, Elise, can you still get CD images for Core 11, or do you just get DVD images these days?
I think they stopped in Core, I think they stopped doing the CD ones in 8 or 9, actually. Because for a while there, you could get both sets down. You just get, you know, you used to get the ISOs down. I think they were the same amount of data, but just across five or six CDs, and you also had the choice of the DVD. That was my first Fedora installation back in 6, because I was FTPing down under Windows, and I thought, well, it's better to break 600 megs of transfer rather than, you know, find I get to the end of the 4 gig one and find I missed the last bit. So I don't think they're supporting it anymore. I think it's a DVD image only from about 8 or 9, I think. I can't remember which version, but certainly by now it is. It's only DVD.
Okay, now if you happen to want to be installing Fedora onto your system and you are vision impaired, you might actually want to have a look at www.speakup-modified.org. I think it's called, and or Google for Speak Up Modified Fedora, and you'll actually get Fedora images that have Speak Up embedded in them. And you'll actually, that means if you've got hardware speech synthesizer, you'll be able to get speech during the install, and that's very handy. Or you can actually do some nifty tricks with Red Hat and stuff. You can actually get it to use a serial console, so that you can actually install using the serial console. And it is also possible to fire up.
Does it.
Yes, and you can also fire up an SSH in there somewhere as well. Ubuntu, you can fire up an SSH in the early parts of the install, so if you can get somebody to push you through the first bits, you can then get SSH in to get access. Gentoo, you can certainly fire up SSH. And GRML, you can fire up SSH if you're installing that to hard disk, so that's another way for us to do it. And just a note that Debian 5, the current unstable edition of Debian, now has SpeakUp embedded in the installer images, including support for software speech.
Nice.
Also note that Vinix 2.0, which is now based on Debian Unstable, which is fairly stable, the snapshot that he's based on it on, is also now available from vinix.org.uk, and it is a CD that when you boot it, it will come up with speech and braille out of the box. If your braille display is not a USB type braille display that is recommended by BRLTTY, you will have to explicitly specify the parameters for your braille display, but you will get speech and braille out of the box, and it will give you the method of trying.
How good is that, eh?
Yeah, pretty much. Does anybody know whether you get braille at install time on the Mac?
Don't know.
Yeah, they do.
We're just talking about whether you get... Yeah, okay, so you don't get braille during the install on the Mac at this point, but you do get speech when you first install it, and then the braille comes up once after the first reboot or whatever.
It's very easy.
Speech and braille support in Vinix 2.0. And in fact, I might actually burn a bit of our bandwidth and pull down the Vinix CD and we'll boot it on one of the workstations and have a look. Anybody interested in having a tamper with that?
Absolutely. That'd be totally fine.
Alrighty.
Oh, hell,
so,
I wish I was over there right now.
Yeah, oh, well, you'll be over here in November, and we'll keep the CD around so you can have a play too.
Thank you.
Okay, this thing talks about the Linux Router project, which uses a floppy to bootstrap a distribution of Linux, which turns your computer into a router. So you put a couple of network cards or some various hardware in there, and that turns your computer into a router. Sadly, the Linux Router project is now defunct, and we are actually looking at different distributions. There are whole lots of small Linux distributions that are out there now that run off floppies or USB thumb drives or stuff. I don't know whether anybody's looked at it, but there's a thing called DSL, which actually stands for Damn Small Linux, and it's actually a Linux that takes up about 40 meg of disk space, runs in 12 meg of RAM, and has a full graphical user interface environment. Not accessible to us, but still pretty cool.
Good grief. So you could boot yourself off a... could probably run that on a memory off a memory stick.
You can run it off a memory stick, and in fact GRML will run completely off a memory stick if you want it to. I made one up at home. And it also runs off... and you can actually run GRML completely off a 2-gig thumbstick, or even a 1-gig thumbstick. But you can also run DSL off SD cards, MMC cards, compact flash. In fact, it's possible to run Damn Small Linux off a 64-meg compact flash card, if you can find one.
How do you make those things bootable, those compact flash cards, or SD cards and memory sticks?
You actually put a partition table on them and tag the partition as active and put a valid master boot record on like you would with a hard disk. There's two ways of partitioning up flash media. You can either have it with a partition table or without a partition table. By default, they don't have a partition table and they've just got the boot sector of the file allocation table and things like a floppy. But if you actually put the partition table on and tag the partition as active, you can actually boot the thing, you can actually boot from a card reader. And in fact, you'll probably know that if you've played with an EE box, and I think even the EE PCs do it, I think they default to having the card reader bootable before any of the hard disks, which is kind of handy.
That would be cool, because you could put... Well, I've got a 16-gig card in mind, but I could make up a 2-gig card with a GRML on it or something. Just a quick and easy
fix. Exactly right.
I might go and try that this way. I've got GRML here. Because then it all sounds good.
Yeah. So you can actually boot your machine from a compact flash or whatever card you happen to have, so that's kind of nifty. There are dozens of small Linux distributions, and some of them are really cool. I can't remember what the names of a lot of them are, but there are some quite nice ones, and there are Behring, That's right. Burring is one of the router distributions, and that runs on the Linksys routers, and it runs on PCs, and it runs on all different other sorts of things. The other one that people might want to have a look at is a thing called FreeNAS, which is a distribution of FreeBSD that comes up off a floppy or a compact flash or a memory stick, and it turns your little old computer into network-attached storage, which is kind of cool. But not part of this module, unfortunately. Okay, the notes go through the installation media. Scrolling. Okay, basically when you install Linux, it asks you what language you're using, it asks you what keyboard you're using, it asks you what time zone you're using. Pretty similar distribution.
To a Windows.
Yeah, pretty much like Windows and stuff. Basically, this is so that your keyboard can work and so that you can actually figure out what locale you're in and all of that sort of stuff. So you select those settings, and then it'll basically, under Red Hat, it fires up the partitioner, which I think, if memory serves me correctly, is a thing called Disk Druid or something now. And it's all GUI and stuff.
Yeah, Disk Druid.
Read the license if you haven't already, and make sure you agree with it, especially if you're using one of the Linux distributions that is not fully GPL and open source. Now, just a point here, there's Fedora and there's Red Hat Enterprise. There is also a project called CentOS. I think it's CENTOS, www.centos.org. That will actually give you an unbranded version of the Enterprise Red Hat Linux that is an open version that can be used inside the community. Pretty nifty. Then you've got to select things like your mouse and your keyboard, and you've got to select things like, you know, as I said, you know, where it's going to be partitioned. Now, these notes talk about setting up the X server. That is generally done automatically under modern Linux distributions ever since, I think, about Fedora Core 7, they managed to figure that out, and Debian does it, and Ubuntu does it and stuff, so you don't actually have to explicitly set it up, unless, of course, your screen goes black, whereupon you find another computer and Google up the specific command line incantations to feed in on the boot prompt to get your machine to install. X-Force Visa springs to mind, and that is to allow your X server to come up and work on, say, for example, some of the netbooks and stuff that Linux is suitable for running on. A lot of people run Linux on their netbooks, and in fact we may investigate the possibility of resizing the partitions down on our MSI Wins and dropping a copy of Vinix onto the end in case we want to boot into it and tamper with it, because it tends to be nice on battery life and it could be a bit of fun. And then if we don't like it, we can blow it away and resize the partitions back up. How do you find Fedora on your EEPC, Elise?
Well, I haven't done it yet. That's the whole thing. I've got it to do. Sort of been thinking of doing it for about as long as I've owned the Triple EPC. So I've decided definitely before I come over to Perth, I'll do it.
Okay, so we're all still talking about it.
We're still talking about it. However, Craig's done it and says it's good. Although in the last time I did tell him, speak with him, he claims he lost contact with his network. So I don't know what he did to break his network. But he did have Fedora 10 running on there quite satisfactorily at one point.
Excellent. Now, then you have to pick out which sort of file system you're going to use. Now, we can all sort of, we can also select which various file systems you can use, and we can all stick our dukes up and have an argument about who's using which file systems and which one's best. Basically, you want probably EXT3 or EXT4. You also want...
4 is now supported in 11?
Yes, it is. EXT4 is now supported in 11. It's a bit experimental. It's also supported in Ubuntu. Or you can use RicerFS, which is no longer under active development. There's JFS, which is another one that's written by IBM, which has sort of had bug fixes applied to it. My favourite file system at the moment is XFS, because it has a defragger and a reorganiser and stuff. And apparently there's Mac has implemented ZFS, I hear, which is the new swish-bang one from Spark, Solaris.
Oh, okay, cool.
Oh, it's coming soon, as it is to Linux, so everybody's hanging out. And ZFS has got some very impressive things like storage containers and automatic migrations of big chunks of data and all of that sort of good stuff. So we'd have to Google that up, but apparently it's very flexible and very cool. You have like clusters of storage and all that sort of good stuff. Also, modern versions of Red Hat use a thing called the Logical Volume Manager, which we will not be talking about in these lectures because it is all a bit complex and bizarre. Okay, you are given the option as to whether to perform a bad blocks check. Most hard drives these days are bad block free. Most. And if yours isn't, you probably want to send it back and get a new one. If you're going to do a production server or something, sometimes it is actually worth doing a bad blocks check on the hard disk to make sure that there are no bad blocks, unless you know for a fact that the drive is clean. Okay, low-level format redefines the physical sectors on the hard disk, and it is quite a difficult thing to do. Talk to a mutual friend of ours, and he will bemoan this fact. High-level formatting is where you put stuff onto the predefined sectors. Low-level formatting redefines the sectors. High-level formatting puts stuff onto the sectors on the hard disk. This is in your test. Okay.
I was just going to say that. Definitely in your test, that one.
You use FD format to format a floppy disk. You use FD format to format a floppy disk. You use FD format to format a floppy disk. That is also in your test. And you use MKFS to put the file system on the floppy disk. I believe that's also in your test.
It is. You have been warned.
Make file system.
Okay, and it's also saying that you basically select which packages you're going to install, and you're going to have a limited amount of disk space to install on. Yeah, these notes are really dated. What's the smallest hard drive you can get your hands on today? At least I think the smallest I've seen is 80.
That would be about right.
40. You can do a 40 if you really try.
Good grief, I didn't even think you could. I haven't seen a 40 brand new for a long time. I think an 80 gig hard drive, the last 80 gig hard drive I saw new, was the one that actually came in my EEE PC back in December last year. And as Kerry says, you can probably still get them. But I wouldn't even think about buying a 40 now.
When I was doing my research for ITE1, I think I saw a brand new 40 gig hard drive.
Was it Pater or SATA?
Wow.
It was Pater.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know how many SATA 40 gigs are, even if the things exist, they're floating around out there.
My experience is the smallest thing you can get these days is an 80 gig PATA, and even then you're lucky, because a lot of people don't even stock the parallel ATAs anymore.
You can very rarely get a parallel ATA drive now. I was looking back in, I think it was February this year for them, and I just gave up.
Yeah, no, it's quite difficult to find them, although I do know of a couple of places that do sell them. I think one of the stores I use sells an 80 and a 320 gig parallel ATA 3.5-inch drive. You can often get the PATA laptop drives still. Whilst there is limited space, and if your partitions are small, then perhaps you may have trouble fitting stuff on, but I'm going to go out on a ledge here and say that if you've allocated at least 20 gigabytes to Linux, I think you're going to fit most of the things you'd probably ever want on there.
Oh, easy.
Program-wise, yeah.
Yeah, roughly, I think I can check for you in a minute when I'm not putting hand cream on. But I think we usually say about 8 to 10 is fine for Fedora. But yeah, certainly 20 would be more than adequate.
The server install of Ubuntu is 800 megabytes, so make sure you've at least got 800 meg to install onto. I actually find that you can have a serviceable install of Ubuntu server in 2 gigabytes of storage, and that includes swap space. And we'll talk about swap space in a minute.
Yeah, I think we'll have to mention what the notes say. I haven't got them in front of me at the moment, but... because I know it's in the test too, what's the recommended size for your Red Hat 7.1 install, which is something very tiny by today's standards.
Does it say? I'm just looking here.
I thought it did. I'm only going back on my memory of it all about from 12 months ago. I'm sure it was there. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Okay, it basically talks about multimedia support for Linux. Sorry, Geraldine?
No, I was just going to say that.
Oh, sorry. And they say that it's the last mile in Linux support, and basically they say that you have there are multiple options for sound drivers under Linux these days. They say that ULSA is now an option. I would say now that ULSA is a requirement as of 2.6.15. I think the only thing you could have was ULSA, unless you buy the commercial open sound drivers. NVIDIA releases a closed source driver for their video chipsets, as does VIA. However, ATI have direct rendering infrastructure drivers in the kernel, and apparently now you can get, there are some open source, open Chrome drivers for the VIA stuff, which runs on the Mini Notes, and there is also, Linux now supports audio over HDMI, and it supports audio output through the video cards that are capable of doing that. To test whether accelerated video with support is supported, use XVinfo, and apparently that's new in X.org version 4, has got all sorts of direct media and rendering and all sorts of funky stuff. MPEG-1s will play, MPEG-2 need special support, and AVI you need all of the bizarre codecs. There is a thing called MPlayer from www.mplayer.hu, I think it is, or... Yeah, I think that's what it is. And you can install that, and if you take the necessary bits out of Windows, which is probably illegal, you can play all different sorts of movie formats. A guy called Joe Hansen went to jail for a long time for breaking the content scrambling system on DVDs. However, his work has allowed open source DVD players to allow you to watch movies under Linux.
I wonder how long he got.
Also, Zine, or Sheen, I think as Jaws says it, X-I-N-E is a fairly good movie player. But basically you'd have to look around for what's available for your operating system. There are also some quite good multimedia players, things like Amarok, can't remember the names of other ones, but Sheen, Amarok, and all that sort of good stuff. And MPlayer, of course. We like MPlayer because if you're vision impaired, you can actually get it to play the DVD audio without playing the movie, and that can be very good, especially if you have a box that doesn't have a decent video card in it. You can just listen to your movie or dump it to WAV files to be played later.
Yes, it works quite nicely on the command line, good old MPlayer, as well as it does under XWindow.
It does, and you can even specify the chapter and section of the DVD you wish to watch from the command line.
Yeah, you can too, yeah.
And it talks about how you can actually configure Sheen to compile. You do a .configure make install, and if that fails, you apparently edit /etc/ld.so.conf and add user local lib in there, and then rerun ldconfig and then rerun the compile step. That isn't in your test, luckily, but often reading the file called install with a capital I inside the source code archive will often give you hints on how to install the program. Now, this is important. There is the option to do a... Fedora doesn't let you do a server install, does it? It's just a workstation operating system?
You can do one, I think you can select. I know you asked me that question last year too, and I keep forgetting. I think you can do a server or install, or we didn't really go through the custom one anyway.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, the notes say you can actually select whether you're doing a workstation or server install. And if you're doing a workstation install, just be aware that it doesn't start services like SSH and Telnet, so you can't actually Telnet into the thing unless you explicitly enable the services on it if you do a workstation install. They reckon you can install... the basic requirement for Linux is an Intel-compatible processor. If it asks you that in the test, then tell them that, but that's rubbish. Linux runs on about 30 different architectures now.
That's pretty good.
A hard disk with 900 meg of free disk space is recommended, is the spec they're giving.
There it is, yeah. Yeah, there it is, 900 meg, that sounds familiar.
16 meg minimum RAM, 64 is recommended. I'd actually be tempted to say 128 is the realistic minimum these days, and the more the better, 256, 512, 768. One of the interesting things about Linux is it uses memory for... holding programs, and it also uses it for the disk cache. So any memory that's not used for holding programs is actually used for caching bits of stuff off the hard disk. So the more memory you have, the more stuff will be held in memory rather than being pulled off the hard drive. Always check your hardware compatibility.
Lots of memory in the power go. If you've got lots of memory then, or lots of RAM, and you're in the middle of using your Linux box as a mail server and stuff, and the power goes off, you could be in a bit of trouble, right?
Well, that's the same with any server. However, it is worth noticing that Linux actually has what we call a BD flush, which is a buffer Buffer's dirty flush process, which is responsible for purging all inode changes to the hard disk every 5 seconds and all data changes to the hard disk every 30 seconds.
Yep, fair enough.
If you actually install a thing called laptop mode and stuff, it can actually wind those parameters up quite a bit. So you have to figure out whether a power loss will cause you grief. And this is one of the things that we won't go into heavily here, but this is one of the things why I warn you against spool files. If you lose power on your mail server and you corrupt your spool files, they are not much fun to rebuild, especially if they're big.
Yep, sure.
It's talking about the Cyrix 6x86 and the 6x86MX. Look, they're all older processors. Linux does run on them. It runs on the Pentiums. It runs on the Via chips. It runs on the Transmeter Crusoe. It runs on the Pentiums, the Pentium 3s, the Pentium 4s, the AMD, the X64, the Itanium architecture. So just be aware that it runs on all of those different sorts of things. And there's a link you can follow. And Linux also runs on symmetric multiprocessing computers, which includes any processor that has more than one core. And in fact, a lot of us have dual-core machines sitting in front of us. I've got one that's dual-core. However, note that the Atom is not dual-core, it's just hyper-threading.
Sure.
Just going on, talking about configuring things then. Printer configurations and all of the tweaking that you want to do after install.
Yeah, there are basically various GUIs and things that will auto-detect your printer, and basically most of the distributions have switched to using a thing called CUPS, the Common Unix Printing System, which is a thing that's sponsored by Apple. And basically with CUPS you get this web browser interface and you can whiz through and configure all your printers in that. And if you've got the correct drivers, either from gutenprint.org or Fumatic, you can actually configure most common printers. Do make sure that your printers do have Linux drivers, however. There are actually some GDI printers which are only drivable under Windows and do not have Linux drivers, although that is starting to change because people realised they were losing out on an incredible section of the market by not supporting Linux and, in fact, the Macintosh.
Then we go into the boot options, like the bootloader and Lilo.
Okay, there are two bootloaders. One is Lilo, which is the older Linux loader. The other one is Grub. There are actually reasons why you would select Lilo, because Lilo will come up to a boot prompt, and that means that blind people can type things, and you can also make it go beep when the prompt comes up so that you know when to type things. It is a little bit harder for a totally blind person to edit the command line boot options for Grub, unless you redirect it over a serial console. The good thing about Grub is that it can actually read file systems and it can find its different stage 1, stage 2 bits and pieces, regardless of where they are on the file system. I am going to say this and I'm going to emphasize it. If you recompile or put a new kernel on your box and you are running Lilo, rerun Lilo. Rerun Lilo. If Lilo does not know where your kernel files are stored, your system will be rendered unbootable and you will need to fix it with a boot floppy.
And the other thing, know a little bit about this because it's also in your test.
In your test, yep. You don't have to do this with Grub, but you definitely have to do it with Lilo.
Okay, basically you need to set your root password for your root account, and you usually need to create a user account or user accounts at install time and set the passwords on those. This is very important.
User accounts?
So I was just going to say root account is the super user and they can do anything. So what were you going to say there, Geraldine? I'll let you.
Oh, we're just saying that we're going on to Xserver 386 and configuration.
Some Linux distributions, and especially the some of them actually have checks on the password and stuff when you use it, but usually they have an option where you can go use weak password and sort it out later. X486 configuration, or X.org as I think it's known now, often happens. There are a couple of ways of reconfiguring X486. In the modern versions of X4.1 and later, most of it should be auto-detected, and the configuration file is only used to override defaults that cannot be auto-detected. Plug-and-play support and stuff has come a hell of a long way in Linux, and often it is better as good as, if not better than, Windows as far as plug-and-play support is concerned, assuming the hardware is supported.
At least you don't get driven mad by it, by, oh, you've plugged the device in and it tries to plug and play it and puts up all these wizards every time you turn the computer on. If it doesn't know it, it won't hound you about it.
This is true, although that silly thing that comes up at boot on Red Hat when you install things annoys the you-know-what out of me. I know it can be turned off, but it's a real pain. Can't remember what it's called.
When you boot up or install?
When you boot the system up and you've got a new piece of hardware and it throws up that wizard and you can decide whether or not you're setting the device up or not.
Don't think I've ever seen it.
Hmm.
Not in Red Hat. Oh, Fedora. You talk about under X or on the command line.
Comes up at the console. If you actually change the hardware in a server, it throws up this wizard thing that asks you to set the hardware up if you put in a different network card or something.
Oh, right, eh? It might well do too, yeah. Might just run first boot or something.
And after you've configured it all, you've got the post-installation. Things like Red Hat Package Manager and Tarballs, Kerry.
Yes, now RPMs are Red Hat packages and they are pre-packaged by somebody and you can install those either off your distribution CD or off various Red Hat repositories using Yum or one of the other, or using RPM directly. And a tarball is basically, and this is in your test somewhere, it's a compressed tape archive. Usually they're called tar.z or tar.gz or tar.bz2. tar.capital Z is the extension for the compress format. The extension for the compress format is .capital Z. The extension for the compress format is capital Z. I'm sure that's in the file. And when you actually untar things, you can then build things from source, and sometimes it is required to build things from source if no packages are available. But I would strongly recommend that you search for RPM packages and install those rather than building from source unless you have no other way. You can also set limits on processes in etc.limits.conf, and the notes talk about that, so I would refer you to your notes.
Yeah, there's a lot in here you will have to go over in your notes. What about gzip? That was something that comes up.
Ah, yes, gzip is GNU's version of a compression program. It actually uses the same deflate algorithm as zip, which is why it's called gzip. And the extension for gzipped files is .gz or .gz, if you come from that other place.
That other place.
So you can get tar.gz files. And they are actually gzipped tar files, which tend to have a better compression ratio than .z, which is your compressed file format. The reason they had to move towards .gz was because Unisys holds the patent on the compress algorithm, and you weren't actually supposed to be using it without paying them royalties.
What about CPIO?
Oh, I've never known why this is in this course, but CPIO is a thing called copy in, copy out, and you can actually use it to create archives or extract archives, and you basically do a find space and then an expression bar CPIO space dash O space archive name, and that copies the files out into the archive, or you can copy files back into the file system by using cat archive name bar CPIO space dash I. I think I've got that round the right way. Basically check your man page or do a CPIO dash dash help. I generally tend to use AFIO rather than CPIO because it supports compression of individual files and splitting across volumes. Hopefully, I don't think CPIO makes it into your final test, but it probably makes it into Chapter 10's test.
I think we sort of almost covered what we need to cover in that module. Anything you think we might have forgotten, Kerry?
But most just of looking.
It. Yeah. Makefile?
Makefiles are the control files that actually let you build source, and it's makefile with a capital M. Now, just a warning here, Linux is case sensitive. It is case-preserving, and it is case-sensitive. Linux is case-sensitive. I cannot emphasize that enough. So capital L, capital S is not the same as LS. So watch out if you leave your caps lock on, all your commands are going to fail. Makefile has a capital M in it, so it's makefile with a capital M and the rest in lowercase, and it actually controls the building of stuff from your source, and you'll be using makefiles if you actually compile from source.
Hmm.
Ah, and I was right. Dash O writes an archive to the standard output where you can redirect it onto a file system, and dash I actually reads an archive from standard input and writes the contents out onto the file system. Hey, I surprise myself sometimes. I think that's about it. I'd suggest you read the notes.
I think so, yeah. Thank you for...
And if anybody's got any questions, get back to us next week and we'll try and tidy them up.
And we'll see if how much all of us here have taken in by a quick quiz. You can do this one too, Kerry.
See what I will. I would just like to flog at this point on the lectures. If you haven't sent your testimony as to how good the CAVI courses are, can you please write a few paragraphs and send them to cavi-instructors@gots.net?
This is very important. And thank you, Elise, for yours. It was good.
Did you read it?
Okay. I did. Okay. What is the minimum amount of memory required to successfully install a Linux operating system? And I believe this is in your test too. Is it A, 8 megabytes, B, 16 megabytes, 32 meg, 64, 128, or 256? That's 8? No, oh, they've got it all good. Yeah, 16.
That was then.
I was
going to
go back over that. That was then. What are the two common installation classes for the Red Hat Linux 7.2 operating system? Is it A, Workstation, B, Media Station, C, Kiosk, D, Server? A.
A and D.
And D.
A is what I meant to type, I beg your pardon. A and D.
A and D works for me.
A and D is what I want. Yeah. Yeah, you got your A now.
A Linux workstation should be configured with the TCP/IP protocol. Which of the following services will automatically supply the TCP/IP information to the workstation when it boots? Is it A, DNS, B, FTP, C, HTTP, or D, DHCP? Oh, that was pretty sure, wasn't it? That's good, DHCP. Which Windows 2000 user is similar to the root user in Linux? Is it A, the guest, B, the administrator, C, the supervisor, D, the default user?
Well, I can't answer that question because I got this 20-second pause halfway through the question.
Which one is similar to the administrator user under? Oh, in similar to the root.
Yeah, it was so bad.
You just answered it. The root. Yeah, the administrator is correct.
And we've shut the web server down, so there's nothing else we can do. Elise, sorry, if you get 20-second pauses, that's the interwebs being nasty to you.
Can't do much about it.
Okay, what is the minimum amount of free space that you need to have to create the partitions needed to install Linux? Is it A, 250 meg, B, 600, C, 900, D, a gig, or E, 1.5 gig?
Yeah, that's correct.
What is the default bootloader for Red Hat? Is it GNOME, A, B, Grub, C, Boot L, or D, Lilo? The default bootloader for Red Hat Linux.
Is it GNU Grub now, is it?
No, it's GNU Grub. I said N-E-W, Grub, in other words. It's now Grub. It used to be Lilo when I think these notes were written.
Yes.
I think they're on the cusp of Lilo and Grub back when these were written. It's now, I think...
Yes, they're actually Grub. Saying Grub, though.
Ah, so it had switched across. Okay, so it is Grub.
Yep.
And that's it, folks. That's all, folks. The next week we got more on Linux. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. I have a question.
Go for it.
The question is, in the options column of the FS tab file, where we can use the no auto switch to not necessarily automatically mount an NFS share or a drive, will the no auto switch work on an NFS share?
Yes.
Excellent, because then depending on what order everything happens, it would be rather nice if the Raylink drivers came on first on Triple EPC. That way, if FS Tab actually gets to happen, it will mount the NFS shares, and that way it won't have to happen if the laptop's away from my network.
It's not that easy, because what actually happens is NFS is started well and truly after your network drivers come up, so your Raylink drivers will be up before the NFS has tried to be mounted.
That's good, that's what we want.
But if you're away from your network, if you don't have no auto set, it'll try and mount that automatically.
It'll try and mount it. That's why I want to set the no auto, because if I'm away from my network, it won't care.
That's right. There are actually various packages that will actually look at your network location based on the information that's returned by the DHCP servers and stuff, and twiddle all the necessary bits to either force or prevent the mounts from happening if you're away from your home network. So that's something you could also look into if it interested you.
Yep, thanks for that.
Alrighty, I think I'll stop recording and I think we're done.
Absolutely, yeah. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.